This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Dr. Andy Thompson is a psychiatrist in private practice here in Charlottesville, Virginia. He's also a member of the Counseling and Psychological Services staff at the UVA Student Health Services. He also works with Region 10 and is on staff at the UVA's Institute of Law, Psychiatry, and Public Policy. Dr. Andy Thompson joins me live in studio. That's a mouthful. You're a very busy man. Thanks for being here, Andy.
Thank you for having me.
We have a whole lot we want to talk about, and I've really been looking forward to this conversation. And we'll have you for the full hour here. And we want to let folks know, again, the phone number, in case you want to join the conversation, is 977-1070. Listener, you are welcome at any time if you've got a question or a comment for Dr. Thompson. Andy, let's start with a 101, just a little bit about yourself and where you're from and how you grew up and became a psychiatrist.
I was born in Washington, D.C., raised in Alexandria, Virginia. Went to Duke University for my undergraduate training, then came to University of Virginia for medical school. Stayed for my residency in psychiatry and just been here ever since.
Hard to leave, isn't it?
Very hard to leave. Great place.
So when did you first come to Charlottesville?
August of 1970.
70. So you've seen some changes here.
Yes.
Just a little. They didn't even have the 64 hadn't even opened yet in 70.
I don't think so.
Yeah, I think that was 71 or 72.
Yeah, 8,000 students, I think, all total.
And of course, that's before the downtown mall and before 29 North and all that good stuff.
Yeah.
Wow. Thank you for being here. The best place to start in discussing your work is we want to talk about your research on antidepressants and the effect on the brain and your work on why we believe in God. But preface all of this by telling us about this field that you work in, evolutionary psychology. Is that the best way to put it? Or what name can we put on it that talks about how the brain works?
Its original name was sociobiology. It has changed into evolutionary psychology. In many ways, it's an outgrowth of the cognitive neuroscience revolution and the application of evolutionary biology, Darwinian principles to the mind and the brain.
And so how the brain has changed over time and adapted and what we deal with today?
The way to think about it is the mind is what the brain does, and the brain, like every other piece of living tissue, evolved under the rules of Darwinian natural selection. A way of thinking about it is that every living organism, if you think every plant, every animal, it's an integrated collection of problem-solving devices, adaptations, and these adaptations are functional. And they evolved over deep time, over evolutionary time, to promote in some way the genes that built those adaptions. Now, that's a mouthful. Think of it this way. The heart solves the problem of pumping blood. Hemoglobin solves the problem of transporting oxygen. The lung solves the problem of extracting oxygen from the air. At every level of biological inquiry, from membranes to minds, Darwinian natural selection and this view of life. That definition is similar for the mind. The mind, again, is what the brain does, and the brain is this integrated collection of problem-solving devices that evolved over evolutionary times, from simple brains to the brains of human beings that are probably, you know, one of the most complex, if not the most complex, in the world.
We're talking with Dr. Andy Thompson at the University of Virginia. Honored to have him live in studio. I'm Coy Barefoot. It's Monday on Charlottesville Right Now, and I hope you're doing well, and I'm glad to be back live on Rose Hill Drive. What do you say to somebody who would listen to what you just said and say, it didn't evolve, there's intelligent design, I read a book on intelligent design, there's all sorts of evidence for it, how, you know, with the mind, and clearly there is the imprint of a designer on this end product.
Well, one of the adaptations in our mind is a bias towards seeing design in things, seeing functions. It had a survival benefit, and you see it most clearly in children. If you ask a child what a stone is for, a child is going to say it's for an animal to scratch itself. When you ask a child what a lake is for, they're going to say for fish to swim in. our minds are biased towards looking for explanations, for design, for creation. And it's a very natural extension of the way our minds are built to believe in or accept sort of creationist beliefs. But in intelligent design, I think, is simply wrong. And a Republican judge in Pennsylvania essentially said so.
We're talking with Dr. Andy Thompson at the University of Virginia. Let's talk about your research on antidepressants. And tell me, tell us about the research, and then tell us some of the things that you've learned and some of the conclusions you've come to.
Well, this was work done with Helen Fisher, an anthropologist at Rutgers and now in New York City. And again, you go back to that view that I just mentioned a little while ago, that the mind and the brain and our body contain these problem-solving devices, these adaptations, very specific adaptations. And if you look at our sexual romantic life, again, it's made up of very, very specific adaptations. We experience it consciously as a seamless whole, but it's really very specific components. And the antidepressants, which are widely used, particularly any antidepressants that boost a neurotransmitter called serotonin, cause sexual side effects. And we think, Dr. Fisher and I think, that these sexual side effects are perhaps a little bit more serious than appreciated. And in my own patient population, I would have people that said that they felt they no longer loved their spouse and had even thought about divorce. And really what they were experiencing was a sexual side effect of the antidepressants. Another way of looking at it, again, is that sexual desire is an adaptation. It's what gets you on the playing field. Then romantic love is an adaptation that gets you to focus on a particular partner. And the attachment system, the very system that we use for caretaking and parent to child, that attachment system is also used in marriage and bonding. And these drugs interfere with those systems. Now, these drugs are very important. They're very crucial to treating depression. But they do have side effects, and they do have these sexual side effects. And we think they're more serious than appreciated. And we also think that there may be some sexual side effects that an individual isn't exactly conscious of. And there's one Canadian researcher that actually showed that women rating the attractiveness of male faces, when they were on antidepressants, their rating of attractiveness of male faces seemed to be affected, even though they weren't conscious of it.
We're talking with Dr. Andy Thompson at the University of Virginia, and the phone lines are open at 977-1070. Jim, waiting patiently on line one. Jim, you're on with Dr. Thompson. You go right ahead.
Well, good afternoon. I guess I'm curious, before you started talking, Coy made a comment about, and this is why we believe in God, and I guess it's part of an evolution thing. So for what purpose do we evolve?
Yeah, I prefaced the subject, why we believe in God, because that's the title of one of your most recent talks, which we want to talk about today. But I guess Jim's question is there a function or a purpose to evolution itself? Is that right, Jim?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, the whole universe seems to be a changing of energy from one state to another. It seems to be spreading out at an accelerating rate. A lot of things break down. So I certainly believe in evolution, but I don't know why, what force there is or for what purpose we would find one state of being more beneficial or better, quote, somehow qualitatively different from another state of being.
Well, there's no purpose to life other than making more life. That, in a sense, every animal, you and I, are biodegradable packages designed by our genes to get our genes to the next generation. And those animals or plants that had particularly good systems for getting the genes to the next generation are the ones that survived and prospered. If you're looking for purpose, I guess the The purpose of life is to make more life.
We're talking with Dr. Andy Thompson. Jim, thank you for the call. Let's go to Roger on line two. Roger, you're on with Andy Thompson. Go right ahead.
Thank you, and thank you, Dr. Thompson, for taking my question.
You're welcome.
I want to dovetail on the last question, actually, and the comments with regards to the existence of a supernatural being, because at least for many faiths, there is the question of revelation. There's a question of appearances in the past, and there's the historical records that exist for those. You can't go back and prove the resurrection of Jesus Christ scientifically. However, you can prove it legally based on the testimony of those who were there. And I wanted to have a comment on that.
Well, I think that it didn't happen. I think you can have plenty of people with false testimony, but I think it just didn't happen just as a function of what we know about biology. I mean, nobody that we know of currently, I mean, if it was a phenomena that occurred, should be able to see it elsewhere.
And preaching that it did.
What
as
was
well
that?
As the Apostle Paul. Would you die for a lie?
I'm not quite sure what the question is, Roger.
Would you die for a lie? I mean, these apostles that were with Christ, they proclaimed that the resurrection did happen. They were witnesses to his resurrected body. And yes, it is a miracle, and I know Jefferson had difficulty accepting miracles. But if this was the testimony of those who were actually there, and we don't believe that testimony, based on that witness, then, you can't go back and prove the resurrection or the existence of God scientifically, although there is scientific evidence, I believe, to a creator. Our founding fathers believed in a creator. They based the fact that all of our rights emanate from his relationship to man.
Roger, thank you for the call. I appreciate it. And do you want to respond to that?
We're all natural-born supernaturalists. One of the things that has come out of the cognitive neuroscience revolution is to show that from our earliest childhood, we, in a sense, believe in supernatural things. Because we assume that minds occupy other things, and we are very vulnerable to supernatural beliefs. That's one of the things, I think, that one of the exciting things that's come out of this cognitive neuroscience revolution is we now have very good theories with empirical support that show why human minds generate supernatural beliefs. And we're all vulnerable to it.
We're talking with Dr. Andy Thompson at the University of Virginia, and we're going to continue this conversation after a break for local news and weather, which we'll break here in just a minute. But before we do, give us a bit of a preface, and you've already started to do that, about what we're going to talk about in the next half hour. You gave a talk recently, and the talk was titled Why We Believe in God. And it's an evolutionary psychological perspective about how the brain works. And I don't want to speak for you. I think I should stop right there. But give us a preface about what we're going to talk about in the next half hour.
Certainly. Anyone that's interested, if you just Google Andy Thompson, Why We Believe in Gods, the entire talk will show up on YouTube. But it goes back to what I said originally, that the mind is what the brain does. The brain is made up of all these extraordinary adaptions, very few of them actually conscious to us, and that religion is a byproduct, a byproduct of these mechanisms that were designed originally for other purposes. Just like the attachment system was designed to get us to turn for care, it's the system we use to take care of our children, and that attachment system is used in religion. When we're in distress, we pray to an attachment figure. And this is what really religion is. Religion is a byproduct of mechanisms that evolve for other purposes that come together to form religion. And as I'll try to explain in the next half hour, if you understand, for instance, the psychology of the Big Mac meal, it's the same psychology that leads to religion.
We'll do that after a break for local news and weather. My guest is Dr. Andy Thompson. He's in private practice here in Charlottesville. He's a member of the Counseling and Psychological Services team at UVA Student Health. He works with Region 10, and he's on the faculty at the University of Virginia's Institute for Law, Psychiatry, and Public Policy. A break for local news and weather right here on News Radio 1070 WINA. This is Charlottesville right now.
You're listening to my daddy on News Radio 1070 WINA, Charlottesville, right now! Right now! Right now! Right now! Right now! Right now!
It's 37 minutes after 5 o'clock. This is Charlottesville Right Now. It's News Radio 1070 WINA. I'm Coy Barefoot. Happy Monday. Coming up tomorrow on the program, live in studio, John Whitehead of the Rutherford Institute and Brian Wheeler of Charlottesville Tomorrow. On Wednesday, we'll talk with the Provost of the University of Virginia, Dr. Tim Garson. He'll be live in studio. We'll get his thoughts about the evolving new approach to healthcare in America. Republican candidate for governor Bob McDonnell, live in studio on Thursday. Let's rejoin our conversation with Dr. Andy Thompson of the University of Virginia. He's in private practice here in Charlottesville. He also does counseling and psychological services for UVA Student Health. He works with Region 10, and he's on the faculty at the University of Virginia's Institute for Law, Psychiatry, and Public Policy. Andy, I watched a talk that you gave recently that, again, is available on YouTube. You can just Google search Andy Thompson, and the title of your talk was Why We Believe in God. Tell me about this subject and your research on this, because I honestly found it really fascinating.
Well, again, it's not my research, first of all. It's my synthesis of a number of people who've done the research on this. And there's a group of cognitive neuroscientists, anthropologists, psychologists, who have, in the last couple of years, come up with workable theories, empirical data that start to show us. I mean, we're really on the verge of a comprehensive cognitive neuroscience of religious belief, understanding why human minds generate religious beliefs, why they generate the specific ones that they do, and why those religious beliefs are attractive to human minds.
And this is I want to underscore something you mentioned. This is a very new field. This is new science. This is a very totally new way of thinking about religious belief.
It's been around for probably 10 to 15 years. Some of the first publications on this came out in the 1990s. Pascal Boyer's book, Religion Explained, I think is 2001. And it's the last 10 years that this has started to take off. And now there are numerous books, numerous articles. One of the most recent pieces of evidence actually comes out of the National Institute of Health, the National Institute of Stroke, I think, a functional MRI study that starts to nail some of this stuff down. And I think it's absolutely fascinating and really one of the exciting developments in the brain sciences that we're seeing.
So tell us more, flesh it out for us. When we talk about why we believe in God, from your perspective as a scientist and as a psychiatrist,
the theory here is that religious belief is a byproduct of cognitive adaptations that evolved for other purposes. Let me try to illustrate it with the Big Mac meal. All of us, I think if we admit it, like the McDonald's Big Mac meal. Now, why is that? Because we have ancient adaptations that left us craving fat. Why would we crave fat? It was lean game meat. It was crucial for survival. We all crave sweets. The original sweets in our evolutionary history were fruits, ripe fruits, which were crucial sources of calories, glucose, and vitamin C. None of us crave broccoli. We have adaptations that left us craving things that were crucial for our survival. Sweets, sugars, salt.
Proteins, yeah.
Proteins, absolutely. And all of us have those adaptations. Now, a Big Mac meal actually arises from those adaptations, but puts it together in a novel form. Instead of fruit, you have milkshakes. Instead of game meat, lean game meat, you have a fat-rich hamburger, cheese. Instead of just salt, you've got French fries that are also soaked in meat juice. So you have this evolutionary novel package that arises from those adaptations, but then basically hijacks them in a new way. And so we all, you know, crave this Big Mac meal. It's a super stimulus to these ancient adaptations. You might reasonably say, what does this have to do with religion? Okay. We have tremendous numbers of adaptations to negotiate the social world. Reciprocal altruism, attachment, romantic love, what's called theory of mind. All of us know that other people have wishes, beliefs, desires, intentions, and we read it looking in their faces. These adaptations combine in religious ideas. I mean, if you think about it, you know, a god is a parent. That's an authority figure. It's an attachment figure. When we're distressed, we turn to an attachment figure, a parent. Only, you know, just like the Big Mac meal is a super stimulus to those ancient adaptations, a god, an all-powerful parent, is like a super stimulation to our desire for an attachment figure, an ordinary parent. And reciprocal altruism. All of us keep in our minds who we owe and who owes us. Reciprocity is the social glue, one of the real strengths of our species. Look at religion. You know, we set up reciprocal relationships with gods. If I pray, I'll get a good harvest. So there are numerous of these adaptations that were crucial to our survival over the hundreds of thousands of years of our existence as early hominids. These adaptations then come together in religious ideas, very specific religious ideas, that then, in a sense, hijack those adaptations.
Those adaptations that evolved for other purposes,
yeah,
to help us
for other purposes, right,
get along and stay alive,
right,
and pass on our genes. Then religious belief directly correlates with those adaptations.
Yes. I mean, we have numerous, numerous social cognitive adaptations, a lot of them unconscious. And these are many of the ones that are used in religion. And then there's one other phenomenon that really is one of the keys here, which is something called minimal counterintuitive ideas, minimal counterintuitive ideas, MCIs. And what this is the optimal compromise between the interesting and the memorable. Let me illustrate it this way. If I tell you that the tree outside of your house will do your taxes, fix your computer, drive your car, do your shopping, cook, do all of these things, you're simply not going to believe it. It violates too many of the basic assumptions you have about trees. But if I tell you that your tree once a month will hear your prayers, you're a little bit more vulnerable to believe me, because all the basic assumptions about trees are there. But there's just one little counterintuitive twist, and that's what makes it memorable and attention arresting. And if you step back from it for a moment and think of your Judeo-Christian gods, they're physically everywhere. So there's a violation of physics. There's a violation of psychology. They can hear my thoughts. But all of our intuitive assumptions about humanness are still there. God is a man. He can hear. He can think. He can perceive. He can understand my southern accented English. He is basically a human. We don't think about all those things. All those intuitive assumptions we have about humanness are just there and assumed, and there's a couple little twists on biology or a couple little twists on psychology, and that makes it attention arresting and memorable. And that's really one of the things that distinguishes supernatural beliefs from other things, is this phenomenon called MCIs. And then we bring to bear all of our other adaptations to it, like the attachment system, reciprocal altruism, a lot of different ones. But this is the essence of it. Religious beliefs are a byproduct of adaptations designed for other purposes.
We're talking with Dr. Andy Thompson of the University of Virginia, and the phone lines are open if you've got a question at 977-1070. Andy, what are your thoughts on the reaction that I'm sure you must get sometimes from believers, very devout, no matter the religion, irrespective of the religion, very devout people who hear your thoughts as a scientist and a psychiatrist about the evolution of the mind and the things you've been discussing, which can be angry at times from true believers.
Certainly. People get very upset with these ideas. And my response is, I'm not going to argue you out of it. I would just encourage you to read the evidence for yourself. Make up your own mind. It's exciting, interesting discoveries. It's part of the outgrowth of the revolution in the neurosciences. And increasingly, we're having articles and books that are accessible to an educated public. And my response is, read it, look at the evidence for yourself, make up your own mind.
What do you think is the potential of this line of research? Like, where do you think it's going, and how might it help the species in any way?
Well, I think knowledge is power. And I think the more we understand about why human minds are vulnerable to generate religious beliefs and to believe them, I think we have a greater chance of diminishing some of the dangerous aspects of religion. 9/11.
Yeah. And expound on that, because I know you, another line of your research is suicide terrorism. And this, of course, is this taking these fundamental religious beliefs and creating murderers, you know?
Yes. And if we look at the world today, and we look at the conflicts the United States is bogged down in Iraq and in Afghanistan, these are, you know, driven by the parties of God. And the fundamental identity of the Taliban, of Al-Qaeda, is a religious identity. And they can, I think, make otherwise good people do some terrible things. Those 19 young men that crashed into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon were better educated, mentally healthier, than their contemporaries. And how many more times do we have to have engineers and architects slamming into buildings at 400 miles an hour, killing people, before we step back and say, well, maybe we ought to look at what's driving these people and the aspect of it that is religious? The more we understand, the better.
Yeah. Would you agree, though, that in the same sense that we were talking earlier, in the same sense that antidepressants can serve for some people a positive function, that for some people need them? Is there an argument to be made for religious belief, even though as a scientist you might say, hey, this is evolution, folks. Look at what your mind's doing. I mean, this is a Big Mac meal. But is there some fundamental positive force at work?
Well, certainly religions have served a lot of useful social purposes, and religious people, in the name of their faith, have done a lot of good. I think the argument is that it's no longer necessary, that you can be good and you don't necessarily have to be religious.
You can be moral without God.
Exactly.
Ethical without God.
You can be ethical without God. You can be ethical without religion. And the reverse is also true. You can be religious and not ethical. You can be religious and not particularly moral. You can be religious and a murderer.
Yeah. What would you like to see in this particular field of research? What's left to be done? What would you like to see, ideally, your hope for some future work?
Oh, I think it's still being fleshed out. I think we're, as I said, I think we're not there yet, but we're really, when you look at it, and that was the point of my talk in Atlanta, when you start to draw this all together, we're really on the threshold of a fairly comprehensive cognitive neuroscience of religious belief. And I think there's still more to be done to flesh it out completely, but we're getting awfully close, and I think I would like to see it, the research continue to be done, to be supported. I'd like to see some of our good science writers take it and put it into books, more books and articles that are accessible to the public, that are accessible to, you know, high school psychology textbooks.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier, we're talking with Dr. Ante Thompson of the University of Virginia. You mentioned earlier that the National Institute of Health has released a study relative to MRIs that bears on this whole subject.
Yes. In March, it was published, and it's a fascinating study where they took 40 individuals, 20 men, 20 women, and put them in functional MRI machines. And then they read to each of them about 100 statements that had to do with religion and religious beliefs. And then they looked at the areas of the brain that lit up. And there were no specific religious areas of the brain. All the areas of the brain that lit up were areas that were well known to deal with social cognition, emotion, and knowledge. So that all of the activity of the brain, when it directly engaged on religious belief, it lit up, and the areas of the brain that were being used were the same areas that are used for our basic, everyday, ordinary social cognition and managing emotions. It's a unique study, really the first of its kind, and I think it's going to have a lot of influence.
Is this the more lower brain, you know, the older brain, or the higher?
No, it's the higher brain. It's our social cognitions. We take it for granted, but because we don't see all the pieces of it, but we have these extraordinary abilities to mind read. That we know other people have minds with wishes, beliefs, desires, intentions that are different from our own. And we look for cues in reading faces, as listening to language, as listening to tone of voice. And we process all this information to understand what's going on in the mind of another person. And one of the other unique capacities we have, which other animals don't have, is a thing called decoupled cognition. And that's a fancy word for the fact that you don't need a body in front of you to think about a mind. As the listeners out there are listening to me, while they're listening to me, I can guarantee they have thought about some conversation they've had with somebody else, or more likely, they're going home and they're thinking about the conversations that they're going to have with other people, or the things they're going to be having to deal with other people. In other words, they can have a complex social relationship with an unseen other. And we just take that for granted, but it's actually a very extraordinary piece of our cognition that other animals probably don't have. Maybe our cousins, the chimps and bonobos, have a little bit of it. But as you're listening to me, you can think about a conversation that you had with Barack Obama in April. You can think about somebody you're going to interview tomorrow, while you're absolutely paying attention to me and listening to me.
Yeah.
And that capacity to have a complex social interaction with an unseen other, I think if you step back from it and look at it, that's one of the crucial aspects of religion. We have these very complex relationship with gods, which are gods who are really just unseen other people. You know, all religious ideas are based on human mental states. And I think that's what was so important about the National Institute of Health study, is that they showed that there was no specific religious module in the brain. There was no specific area of the brain that lit up. The brain just used these everyday, ordinary social cognitions about intentions and wishes and desires and, you know, reading other people's emotions.
Parts of the brain that have been evolving for hundreds of thousands of years.
Hundreds of thousands of years, but probably, you know, in terms of our species,
tens of thousands.
Yeah. You know, modern Homo sapiens is maybe 160,000 years old, and fully modern Homo sapiens with language probably about 50,000 years old. And I think that's one of the other areas for me that's exciting about this, is that the creation myths we have in most religions are really pretty parochial compared to the extraordinary beauty of science and of what is being discovered. And if you think about it, I mean, we're all really risen apes, not fallen angels. You know, all 6.7 billion people on the Earth today are descendants of a small band of hunter-gatherers that arose in Africa about 50, 70,000 years ago and conquered the world. Now, you were asking me something that might come out of all this knowledge. I think one thing is that it helps us really see who we are, which is, you know, again, every one of the 6.7 billion people on this planet is a cousin of mine. You know, our different races and religions and ethnicities hide an extraordinary fact that underneath our skins, we're all Africans. We're all the descendants of these people that arose and survived in harsh and dangerous environments. Survived and peopled the earth.
Dr. Andy Thompson of the University of Virginia. You can Google him, Thomson. Check out his YouTube lecture, Why We Believe in God. Andy, thanks for being here. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit SeavillePodcast.com for more.